Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Today we're going to be talking with Joe Frodsham. He is the principal and founder of the JBK Group, careerswork.com. Joe, welcome to the show.
How you doing, David? Great to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. You know, I got to tell you, Career Work, you know, one of the things we're going to be talking about here today is about your book, Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization. What a concept.
It is an amazing concept. You know, so many times we look for greener pastures when the pastures really aren't that much greener once you jump over the fence. So it is about how do you make it work wherever you choose to work.
Well, you know, I know that individuals every day sometimes say to themselves, could it be better on the other side? And you bring up a good point, because today, as you know, statistically, people are willing to jump more than ever. The stats are out there right now saying that if I was to call as a recruiter, which, of course, CMA does, we are going to have a really good chance, 70% chance, that somebody will at least talk to us about a new opportunity. So why is that? What are some of the issues and concerns that are out there that really make people always think it's greener on the other side?
Well, it's interesting. I think one, I think, is human nature, where we really do see the blemishes up close and personal in our own lives and certainly our own careers and our own companies. And the apple looks a lot more polished as we look, you know, look at other companies until we get up close and personal, and then, again, they have blemishes. And, you know, that was really, you know, David, the phenomena that we bumped into a couple of years before we wrote the book. It seemed like everywhere we went, and I did co-author it with a guy named Bill Gargiulo, everywhere we went, we'd be talking about spurious things, red wine, places, events, great movies, and inevitably people would tell us, we hate our job. It would just come out of nowhere. They just tell us we hate our job, we don't like it here. You know, and it seemed like it was this pervasive phenomena that we were bumping into, that was this mass, dissonance of people just didn't like their job and their work and their company. And so we decided to make it a point of study and to do some research and really understand what it is, and more importantly, how do we make people or help people carve that career that they've always wanted.
Well, you know, you are one of the things I know we're going to talk about here in the next few minutes is some of the career myths and truths that you outline in the book. There are about four or five, I know. But, you know, to get to the point of why you wrote the book, you decided to study it. What made you decide to study it other than, you know, it was an interesting topic?
Well, it seemed really relevant. The majority of the hours of our adult life are spent in our job and our work. And if most people are in the midst of a mediocre career, then by definition, that leads to largely a mediocre life. And as we looked at the impact, it was pretty profound. I mean, it's kind of the undiscussed phenomenon of our ages, which is, you know, we are very tied to our career. It's where we spend the majority of our time in our lives. And yet most of us really don't enjoy our career as much as we would have liked to. It didn't meet and doesn't meet expectations. In fact, when we put together our instrumentation and did our assessments of thousands of professionals, what we found is anywhere from 9 to 15% are in a career and job that they truly enjoy. The rest of us are in some level of, you know, lack of enjoyment or moderate enjoyment at any given time with our career. So what motivated it is no one's looking at this, yet it's a huge phenomena and it has a huge impact on people's lives, not just their career.
No, you're absolutely right. So let's get right into the heart of these myths that are out there. Give me the first one. What's one that you found in the career that in the book that absolutely says, hey, this is one of the myths that's out there?
Well, you know, we have 16 of them, and, you know, they're all pretty interesting, and they really do explain why people so often are in the midst of a mediocre career, because they're building their career on a bunch of falsehoods, a lot of toxic advice and assumptions that are out there that just aren't true. So when we looked at the, you know, that 9 to 15% of folks who are really loving what they do, we found that they carve it based on a different set of beliefs that often fly in the face of the pervasive kind of wisdom out there or what's accepted to be true around careers. So one of them is, and this sounds real basic, but we found it's a pervasive myth, is to get ahead, you just need to do a good job. You know, if I do my job and I do it really well, I will do very well, and they'll take care of me, and I will, you know, make money and be taken care of, and I'll have this wonderful career. I wish that was true, David.
No, you're right.
I really do. I wish that that wasn't a myth, but it absolutely is a myth. And what we found is, you know, every organization is innately political because it's made up of people. So the skill base of being able to navigate the organization and the political aspects of the organization, both positively and otherwise, is absolutely critical. Doesn't mean you want to be a political animal, but it does mean that you want to build the skills of organizational navigation. So that's one of the pervasive myths.
So when you're talking about making sure that individuals, even though they have careers and they have are doing a good job, talk to me about that politics for just a second. What did they find? Was it about their supervisor? Was it about their individual situation? Was it about the culture? Define that just a little bit more.
Well, you know, all of those would certainly influence how a person feels about their job. But what we found is that those are all kind of extraneous to it. So, you know, a lot of organizations have done a great job of trying to improve their managers, improve communication, improve the incentive system to some degree or the other. And those things can help incrementally. Somebody enjoy their job better and their career more. But fundamentally, if you don't enjoy the nature of the work itself, it's all window dressing. And most organizations don't help people really identify what they need fundamentally in their work in order to be engaged every day. And so what we found is yeah, sometimes the culture in the organization gets in the way, and you do need to navigate it. But I will be engaged as an employee mostly if I enjoy the work that I do, if it's me meeting my specific and unique needs. And that's kind of the punchline of the book is, you know, we talk through how do you identify what your core and unique needs are, and then how do you make those work in whatever organization you choose to be in.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, it's the WIFM, right? What's in it for me at the end of the day?
Sure.
Because that's human nature as well. It's just, you know, this has to do with my life, my job, my career, my family, my. But that's the reality of life.
It absolutely is. You know, and one of the other key myths, and again, we have 16, but one that we found pretty interesting, it's a little alarming, is one of the things that derails people in their career is how we define work-life balance. Meaning that the key myth is the traditional way we define work-life balance is really dysfunctional. A lot of HR departments, and again, I love HR, I've spent most of my career in it, but we'll define it as, hey, there's a certain amount of hours that one needs to work or should work, and then they can get on with their life. And maybe the acceptable number of hours a week is 35 or 45 or maybe even 50 hours, but no more and no less. And then once you've put in those hours at work, then you can get on with your life. What we found is it's not about work-life balance. It's about finding your life's work. I mean, I love, I've got four kids, and I have a family and a wife, and I like to see them a lot. So I'm not suggesting that you should dedicate yourself to only work. Of course you need balance. But the way we define it is that work and life are two different things when they're not. And what we found of those roughly 10, 12% that are constantly engaged and loving what they do is that they found their life's work. And then they have a lot more energy for everything else in their life, including their family and hobbies, et cetera, because they're energized by their work. It is their life. So that's one of those other kind of interesting career myths.
You know, one of the other things you talk about in the book is the two-phase process for an individual to find their career fit. You know, you talk about one, passionate core needs. Talk a little bit about that, because I think that fits right in with what the topic we're talking about is.
Absolutely. So what we found is we started working with people, trying to make this real pragmatic after we did our research. How can we help people really find, fit, and be extraordinarily, radically happy in whatever organization they choose to be in? And so we talked to them. We'd say, well, we'd start with, you know, your passions, and we'd ask them two questions. If you had unlimited wealth, put in the number, $200 million, whatever it is, how would you use your time? What would you do? And then the second question is, if you had 5 years to live with good health, but at the end of 5 years, that's it, how would you use your time? And ultimately, people would share stuff like, I'd travel, I'd, you know, write a book, I'd get a degree, I'd, you know, they'd have a variety of things that are just the core things on their bucket list. And then they'd say, you know what, that's not my job. I'm an accountant, you know, I'm a CPA, whatever it is, and I can't go travel, and I can't do these other things that I'm passionate about. We tell you, you're absolutely right. You can't. But each one of those things, and this is the core principle of Passionate Core, each one of those things are fitting or meeting a need. And once you identify what those core needs are that you have, then you have maximum flexibility to get them fulfilled in whatever organization you choose to be in. So that accountant who loves to travel, loves movies, and loves to write and maybe build things, renovate homes, what they really have a desire for is aesthetic, freedom, and the ability to build things. And if that's really what their need is, travel and some of these other things are just expressions of that. So how can you get those needs met, those core needs met, once you've identified them? And what we have found is there's a one-to-one relationship. That once you identify what are your core needs, you can see I'm happiest in my job when they're met, and I'm not as happy when they're not met, and every gradient in between. So for that accountant that needs to be building things, needs to loves detail and aesthetic of things, and loves freedom, then we got to say, okay, where in your organization, your current role or another role, can we get those needs met? And when those needs are met, you can stay there. It's not about travel and some of these other expressions of those needs. It's identifying those needs and then finding a way to get those met in whatever organization you choose to be in.
We're talking with Joe Frodsham. He is the author of Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization. And we're talking about this great book. You know, one of the things that you talked about here in terms of your two-phase process for an individual to find their career fit was the passionate core need. The second is navigate and make it work in whatever organization they find themselves in. Define that.
Yeah, what we found is there are certain practices that are absolutely critical in order to make it work in the organization that you're in. So, you know, the step one, which we just touched on, is identify my passionate core. Okay, I'm a CPA, identify a particular role or refinements to my current role that will make it work for me. But you know what? I got to live in the real world. I've got to make it work in the organization that I'm in. And how do I do that? And so that's phase two. And we have the six practices of career navigation. And these are very tactile but proven techniques to actually shape and embed and succeed in whatever, you know, role that you define with the organization. And it's and each one of these are powerful, profound, but also very pragmatic. So one of them, for instance, is be the players. What we found is that you know, anytime you want to shape a career and have a certain career declaration or direction, there's usually two or three people who can make that happen in the organization. Those are the key and critical players. How do you influence them? How do you jump into their skin and become a solution to them with what you need and want? It's a very, very simple but very, very useful method to influence and shape the opinion of the key stakeholders that you need in order to get this done. So we have these six practices that help people live and make it work in the real world.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a disconnect between the first and the second, but it's really connected. One is about what you need, your passionate core, and mm-hmm. two is about what they need, right? The people who can influence your life and make your organization work. So it is a combination of your environment, of the people you're working with, the key players, and yourself, what you need, correct?
Absolutely, Dave. That's good insight, man. Very, yeah, absolutely true. And it's interesting because there is this, I need to identify what I need in my work and career, poor need kind of identification. But then you got to make it work within the social milieu and the needs and expectations of the company that you're in and navigating. So it isn't all about you. It is how do you get your needs met in the context of the organization. It's not just about you. It is about us. And so that's the biggest part of the Be the Players. It's getting out of your own skin and becoming a solution to those key players in your environment, so that they not only tolerate what you want to do, they become advocates of it.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, one of the things I noticed in going through the information that you provided for me having to do with your book and your website is that you have on your website an online survey anybody can take. It takes about 7 minutes, it appears, on a career wealth indicator. Could you define what that is exactly and how anyone can go there at www.careerswork.com, careerswork.com?
Absolutely. It's a short survey. It's 25 questions with a three-point scale of each. We ask people to go through with their first gut response. These are the key indicators of your current level of job engagement and satisfaction, or what we call career wealth. And as you go through the questions, you'll see that they have to do with your level of engagement, your health, how you feel, It takes you about 5 to 7 minutes to complete, and at the end of it, you get a number. And the number will tell you what your current level of career health and wealth is. It's a number from 0 to 50. The higher the number, the more engaged and healthy your career is at this point. The lower, obviously, the inverse. But this is very helpful. What we found is, you know, we've had thousands of people take it, and the face validity is terrific. People will take it, and, you know, if they're at 21, that means that, you know, sometimes they enjoy their job, but most days they don't. If they're close to 48 or 49, they really kind of that rare breed that loves what they do and are just jazzed to roll out of bed and get to work every day. And that's, you know, that's terrific. So this gives them a unique insight into kind of what their level, current base level of career wealth and health is.
No, that's great. You know, as we end this segment and we go into the next segment here in a couple seconds, I want to talk about the concept you talked about called engagement, and you defined it as I-N-gagement. Give us a little tease about what that is, and then we'll be right back.
Yeah. Long story short, it's how do you engage people from the inside out? So like we talked before, all the other things that have to do with the job, the money, the communication, my boss, how big my office is extraneous. What we found is people need to connect to the work itself. And so that's where the real power is. And that is what we found is the next phase of engagement is now engagement, you know, engaging people from the inside out.
That's great. We're talking with Joe Frodsham. He is the author of Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
They say it's never too late to be what you might have been. So if you want to turn your passion into your profession, AARP can help you find new opportunities that take advantage of Work Reimagined, a program that leverages the power of LinkedIn. AARP also provides access to tools, resources, and information that can help you at every step. Just a few of the ways AARP helps turn your goals and dreams into real possibilities.
AARP, real possibilities.
Go to aarp.org/possibilities to find tools and guidance.
Real Possibilities is a trademark of AARP.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan.
Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan.
Not the silver plan. Too much trouble. Do they have a stainless steel plan?
I like bronze, like my tan.
Are sunburns covered?
Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group.
Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com. And we're talking today with Joe Frodsham. He is the author of Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization. Joe, thank you again for being on the show today. I appreciate you coming on and talking about this important topic. You know, we're going to now, we kind of talk about, at the end of the last segment, engagement. That's I-N-G-A-G-E-M-E-N-T, engagement. So why don't we discuss the strengths and limits of engagement focus that many organizations have talked about? Really, it's been the buzzword for many, many years now.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you look at the evolution of things and, you know, kind of the latest focus for many organizations and many of my clients over the years has been engagement. How do we get people more motivated, both their hands and their heart and their head in their job every day? And it's absolutely a worthy focus. You know, everyone wins. The employee wins, the organization wins. So engagement has been a huge focus. And usually it is in the form of a survey, and the survey comes back with feedback around the levels of engagement and what a great or not so great place it is that we're working in here. And from that, we have action items, and a lot of times the action items have to do with better communication, more events, management behavior, and how we can make that more effective. And so what we found is those are useful things, and many of the organizations I've worked with and we've worked with over the years have seen incremental improvement in engagement and productivity as they've done those things. But what we've also found is after 4, 5, 6, you fill in the blank number of years of an organization focusing on engagement in that way with surveys and action plans, they hit a wall. They don't see the continued incremental improvement, and yet they need to continue to incrementally improve. And the reason is engagement is focused on the externals. It's focused on those things that have little to do with the job, but where the environment that they're working in, their boss, how much they're getting paid, the kind of events, you know, social hours, these sorts of things, which again are very good, but they're incremental. What we found in order to get sustained engagement, that you have to connect people to the work itself. They have to love the job itself. So, David, you love what you do, I can tell. If you took the Career Health and Wealth Indicator, I'm sure you'd score 50 out of 50 or very, very close. Regardless of kind of who's around you, what's around you, it's the work itself that engages you. How do we get organizations, give them the tools so that people can connect to the work itself? Not as much the externals, but the internals. And so that's what engagement is it connecting people to the work itself. And quite simply, you know, it's a process in our book, except we apply it across departments and organizations, where people will go in and walk through a process, and usually takes half a day, at the most a day, to identify what their core needs are, and then how they look back at their job and say, how am I getting my core needs met? And if I'm not getting them met, can I refine or reframe my job? Or change my job, or do I need to retrench into a different part of the organization so that I can get my needs met? And it's a systemic way of getting people connected to their work by getting their core needs met. The organizations have done it, have had profound results, where all of a sudden they've started to see engagement scores go up, not just incrementally, but drastically, and stay there, because people, again, are connected to the work itself, and they're getting their needs met every day.
What if have you found situations, I should say, where individuals are in a role and organizations find out that the person is in the wrong role? And how does that create situations between the organization and the individual so that they have to redefine their role or what if they can't? I'm just trying to make sure that companies understand that if we're doing this work, it's not only the work for the employee, but it's for the employer as well.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone wins. And that's a really good point. It is employer and employee based. So it's essentially going through a process to say, let's measure the current level of engagement. Obviously, if it's low to moderate, some of your needs aren't being met. And what are those needs, and how can we get those needs met in your current role? If not here, then some other role within the organization. And what the employer gets is a much higher levels of sense of investment, much higher levels of sustained engagement because people are tied to the work itself. What the employee gets, I mean, everyone wins. The employee gets to come in every day and just love what they do. They'll naturally put in not just more hours, usually, although that's not really the goal, but the hours they put in are much more productive. Their head's there. Their soul's there. Their spirit's there. And so where we've done this in different departments and organizations, the employees, we've seen retention go from 18% down to 3%. We've seen engagement scores go from, there's different devices and ways of measuring, from one organization, 72% up to 83% after everyone had gone through the course and kind of digested it for 6 months. So it's had a profound effect, not only because it aligns people to their core needs in a sustainable way, but it also shows that there's a real investment, that the organization cares.
You know, a lot of the times when these courses or any courses take place, the one thing that organizations look at, how will this be looked at in 6 months? Will people just go back to what they used to do? Organizations just go back to it? How do they sustain it, I guess, is the question. Because that's always the challenge when anybody does training, investing, coaching. How does it get sustained, especially if it is changing behavior or changing an organizational structure?
Well, excellent question. You're right. It has to be sticky. And there has to be things that make, in fact, what happens outside the training is more important than what happens in the training, in my mind. And so how do you put those reinforcers in place so that it's something that's not negotiable and it gets embedded in how they think and do things? Two ways. One is the workshop itself, which is usually how we introduce it to organization, is an event. So they do come out of there with some significant commitments and some aha experiences. And then we put in place a couple of things. One is a manager has to be aware of how to have that conversation coming out of the session, which is, you've got to have a very thoughtful, smart career conversation with this person, and this is what they've gone through. See, the manager's got to be baked into the process and have that critical conversation coming out. Two, usually we have a quarterly check-in. And in fact, we talk about it in the session, and they embed it in their individual plans. Sometimes it's us as an external resource. Sometimes we put those resources in the organization, where they'll have a quarterly check-in to ask them, how engaged are you now? How aligned is it? What else? What other work needs to be done, et cetera, et cetera. But what I will say at the end of the day is that this is an employee-centered accountability. What we're really clear about in the session is that it's not anyone's job to shape their career other than themselves, and that we've given the tools and the wherewithal and the support from a manager standpoint to go ahead and do that, including the six practices of navigating their career in the organization. But if they choose not to, that's their choice. And, you know, obviously some will choose not to engage and, you know, still whine about their job a year later. But we found the vast majority won't. They really take the gauntlet and they go with it. And with some semblance of support to help them embed it and make it sticky, we've seen amazing things happen.
We're talking with Joe Frodsham. He is the author of Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization. And the website is careers, C-A-R-E-E-R-S, work.com. Joe, you know, one of the things that people look at when they're talking about engagement or engagement is they just say, hey, why don't I have a survey done? Why don't I just go in, do a survey, take the survey results, and kind of do this myself and look at what people are saying that needs to change? How is that process different?
Well, you know, you're right. That's the typical process, and it's not a bad process. It's certainly better than nothing, and it can give you a nice snapshot of the organization. But what you have to realize is that it's just a snapshot of the organization. So I'll give you an example. I worked at a global company, not to be mentioned, years ago, although if you look at my bio, you can probably figure it out. But anyway, I was working at a global company where we did an engagement survey. It was a census survey, which was open for a month. Halfway through that month, 2 weeks into it, our CEO was asked to leave by the board of directors. And so we ended up tallying all the assessment results at the end of the month. And what we found is the assessment results at the first 2 weeks were very different than the feedback we got the second 2 weeks. Very different. Now, nobody's job had changed except for the CEO, who was asked to leave. But the context and how they felt about the work and the organization and the future of the organization changed drastically. So then we went out and did another census survey and then some pulse surveys a few months after, and we got results all over the place. And what I realized is that our typical engagement survey process has some holes. We take one snapshot, we take a month or two to look at the data, and then another month or two to actually put action plans around it. So we're action planning 4 months later against very old data that might not be relevant anymore. So having a slow, monotonous process that doesn't really respond to the pulse of the organization the way it is now kind of limits its effectiveness, honestly. So what we propose often is, one is, we have, and we'll go in, we'll actually have a department or part of the organization, ask them to complete the career wealth indicator for 7 minutes online. Everyone complete that. And what we get then is a nice distribution or understanding what the level of engagement at the individual level is within 2 days of them completing it. So it's a real-time pulse. And then we're able to go in one by one to each department or area of the organization, introduce a process where it helps them identify their core needs and own their career and get engaged from the inside out. And then we can go back and do measures with real-time feedback, you know, within days after the session and ongoing. And that way we're able to get very, very real-time feedback that's relevant for each individual around what is their level of engagement and engagement. Does that make sense?
No, it really does. I mean, I think what we're really talking about is what we talked about in the first segment. Your process really looks at having everybody check in with their core needs, and that's the individual. And then you do some sort of engagement work with the organization to find out how the organization feels as a collective whole. And you merge the two together, which creates a different snapshot than just using survey results or different things like that to see how the organization feels and maybe department feels, but not necessarily even contributes with what the individual feels.
Exactly. And so we get at the very individual level in a way that, you know, aligns with the organization's needs. Absolutely.
Well, great. You know, one of the things we're going to talk about here in the next segment has to do with how organizations can get the person, job, and culture fit right and taking the guesswork out of it in hiring, promotions, and selection. Joe, tee us up. What's that going to be about?
Well, you know, this is really a passion of mine. I love learning about people. I love understanding their nature and how they tick. And so I've married that passion over the last two decades in really deep assessment and being very contemporary in how you assess people, predict behavior, and make sure that you have fit at every level. So that's what we'll talk about.
Great, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. We've been talking with Joe Frodsham. He is the author of the book, Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organizations. That's on the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan.
Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan.
Not the silver plan. Too much trouble? Do they have a stainless steel plan?
I like bronze, like my tan.
Are sunburns covered?
Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group.
Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today.
We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And we are talking with the one, the only, Joe Frodsham, down in Dallas, Texas. And he is talking about his book, Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization. You know, we've been talking about a lot of things over the first half hour here. We've talked about engagement. We've talked about, you know, the two-phase process for an individual to find their career fit. We've been talking about career-life balance. We're talking some of the myths. But really, at the heart of the everyday world having to do with HR and corporate life, it's about hiring the right talent. It's about promoting the right talent. It's about getting productivity up. It's about making it happen in the organization. It's about a person fitting in the right culture. It's about enjoying your job and making a difference. So this segment we're going to dedicate to the power of assessment, as you talk it, the emergence of highly targeted, efficient, and predictive assessments to help this happen. So give us, lay us out the example as to why this works. Maybe give us an example of how it works, and then take us through the process.
Oh, absolutely. You know, assessment for selection and for development, certainly at the leadership level, is nothing new. I think it's a discipline that's becoming more and more refined and targeted, and we're getting smarter collectively at it. And certainly it's a unique passion of mine. What I love is just the power of it. And this is something that our firm has been doing for a couple decades now. And I've deployed and put in assessment systems inside and outside organizations. So I'll give you an example, and I could give a number, but one within the world of healthcare. It was interesting. I was at Tenet Healthcare, which is the largest publicly traded hospital system in the United States. We got in a little trouble. It's very, very public here a number of years ago, which required a refresh of management. As a result, I was kind of brought in that context of the refresh of management. We had some challenges. We had a government investigation. We had a lot of other things that we were kind of getting through. It created some uncertainty in our environment. As a result, our attrition was astronomically high, and it was really unfortunate. And so we had to put some solutions in place to really get the right talent in-house and in place to execute, you know, the mission, which is so critical when you're talking acute care hospitals. We had about 72 hospitals, give or take. You know, we were mostly selling at that point. And we realized that the fundamental unit of effectiveness was what we called the A-team, the executive team in each hospital. We had to get that executive team right. When they were performing right, then patient satisfaction, the quality of care, and even the financials were obviously directly impacted. Well, to address our attrition and to make sure that we were getting the right people in the door, we had to get smart. And that's where we introduced assessment for selection. and for development. And we first of all identified what are the key predictors, the real predictors of success in tenant and hospital leadership. And then we use that to look at our current leaders and say, you know, how much of that explains kind of their level of performance and their fit. And then we use that model to assess all the new entrants coming into the organization, as we had a lot of openings to fill. And people who are potential candidates inside the organization. And by introducing really thoughtful assessment, not only were we able to look at and pull out Holcomb's razor and focus on those things that were true predictors of success in executive leadership in the hospitals, but we were also able to really do an outside-in approach. So we'd look at internal and external candidates against a common criteria with some benchmarks and so on. So we could say, hey, how do they compare this external person with this person that we know? Long story short, and we've written some papers on it and had them published, our attrition went from 1 year among our executive teams about 38%, which is atrociously high in those kind of roles. After a few years of implementing this, it was single digits, 7-8% for a number of years. The only big variable that had changed was us getting the profile right. And it did have a direct impact over time on our quality of care, patient satisfaction, and the financials in the hospital. Obviously, there's a lot more behind all that, but you know, I've become a real believer, David, that you got to get the right material in the door. Fit matters, and you've got to understand what is it that matters here in this organization, and then who's a fit and who isn't, and be very discriminating on that. And the more empirical you can get around that, the better. The last thing I'd say is a key kind of learning through this process is, how you do it also matters. You can't introduce assessment that's laborious and takes days. You know, most people, especially if they're external candidates, are sneaking off the job and coming in and kind of going through this process. It's got to be efficient. It's got to be predictive, but it's also got to be efficient. And so the tools that we deploy, you know, I often say take 2 hours and avoid the bad employee headache. For 2 hours, after 2 hours of assessment and some insight, we can, you know, hit the fairway. We can let you know with some level of certainty if this person will fit and what their derailers will be. And you'll know them on day one in ways that might take you 6 months otherwise to know them. So we're very passionate about it. We think the ROI is clear, and that's just one of many stories I could give you.
You know, one of the concerns that HR departments have, or, you know, sometimes CFOs have, is when you're talking about using an assessment to determine if someone should be hired, they start thinking about, can we do that? Is there a ramification to having an assessment or building a profile and looking at it from a, if you want to call it a legal stance, and saying, you know, what is it that we can do within the confines of using an assessment to determine who can be hired? And so, you know, if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how individuals in corporations like CFOs and HR directors can use these assessments comfortably, without running the risk of, you know, making sure that they're outside the guidelines for effective hiring, or making sure that they do it in a proper way to make that happen?
That's a great question. And, you know, there's bad use of assessment and really good use of assessment, as we all know, we can imagine. The bad use of assessment would be assessment that isn't connected to the job and isn't, you know, obviously relative to the key predictors of the job, and you haven't done the work to actually identify what those are. Then you're leaving yourself a little at risk and exposed. But when you have done that work, it's actually a real positive from an exposure and risk standpoint, because when you've identified what the key predictors are of a role, and you can show that mapping, and then you're administering assessment against that and making decisions, you know, that are in alignment with that, you're in a highly defensible position. And what we found is that organizations that go through the right process to introduce assessment, They're actually in a much more defensible position than those that don't introduce assessment, because, you know, what we've done is that we've looked at the predictors and we can show the data and show that it isn't discriminatory against any of the protected categories. People that don't do that and don't introduce assessment often can't show that as substantiation. So, you know, the interviews and all that other stuff that they go through as part of the selection process, there's a lot of discoverable stuff in there that could actually, you know, keep them very exposed. So the answer is that we walk through a thoughtful, efficient but a thoughtful process to make sure that truly is we are measuring that which is relevant for the role, We haven't had an issue as far as the defensibility of it. If anything, it makes it it seals it up and makes it airtight as far as those kind of defensible legal issues.
You know, one of the things you talked about was basically 2 hours of assessment that this individual or candidate is going to go through, whether it's an internal candidate for promotion or whether it's an external candidate or coming in from a new organization to the organization. What are some of the indicators that you work with companies to determine to get those profiles built? How does an organization work with you and your team and say, hey, this is how we're going to build a profile? And by the way, we are talking with Joe Frodsham, and this is his book, Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization. Joe, talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, about creating those profiles. There's a couple ways you can do it. At the end of the day, we usually use a success profile process where we have an online tool that is a competency trade-off tool that we will send out to the 10 or 12 people that are experts on that particular level or role in the organization that we're assessing against. And so they'll go through and very efficiently identify what are the predictors of that role. And so, for instance, I've done this at a company called Raising Cane's. We've identified four roles in the organization that collectively we have hundreds of people in those roles. Then when we've been able to work with them to do is identify the predictors of success in those roles, and then anyone we assess against that level in the organization, we're able to identify a fit index. How well do they fit the profile of success in that role? And we found that it is highly predictive. So when, as an individual, if I'm an individual, an internal or an external person applying for a role, and I take the assessment, it will take about 45 minutes to complete. Then depending on the role, I may actually have a 1 hour, or someone in my organization have a 1 hour interview with that person. Based on that 2 hours of investment, we have a really acute, clear picture, not only of who they are, on how well they fit, but where their strengths and derailers will probably be within the organization, within the team, and within the role itself. And you know, a lot of people do very well in the interview, and extraordinarily well in the interview, and then they just don't play out on the job. Other people don't interview so well, but they have the raw material to be radically successful in the job. And we know that interviews themselves are not, on average, very predictive. I mean, we always want to do them. You want to kick the tires. You need to get to know somebody. But we know that the predictive nature of them is very low. So bringing in some more science to surface things that you just won't see in the performance, which is the interview, is absolutely important. So we can do that in a very efficient 2 hours.
No, there's no question that there is a definite merit to using assessments properly and to building a profile to help determine the fit of the organization. So this is absolutely relevant, and I know that companies sometimes struggle to make that determination. Should we go with some or should we not? But they can be effectively used, and it can be, as I like to say, a very inexpensive way of making sure that you got the right fit, because having the wrong fit and the wrong person is a very expensive proposition.
Yes, sir, it is, David, and we've all been there.
No, yes, we have. Absolutely. So we're going to be right back, and at that point, we're going to be talking about putting the right employees in the right roles. It's important, but is it enough? So let's talk about that in the next segment on the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. We'll be right back.
They say it's never too late to be what you might have been. So if you want to turn your passion into your profession, AARP can help you find new opportunities that take advantage of Work Reimagined, a program that leverages the power of LinkedIn. AARP also provides access to tools, resources, and information that can help you at every step. Just a few of the ways AARP helps turn your goals and dreams into real possibilities.
AARP, real possibilities.
Go to aarp.org/possibilities to find tools and guidance.
Real Possibilities is a trademark of AARP.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Today we're talking with Joe Frodsham, and he is the author of the book, Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization, which, by the way, everybody after the show, I recommend you go to the HRPowerHour.com site. His information will be on there. His book will be on there. You can click on the link, and it will take you directly to Amazon to buy the book, which I know Joe would appreciate. Yes, Joe?
Yes, sir, I would. Thank you, David. I got to feed my four kids.
Absolutely. No problem at all. All right, we talked about in the last section about the power of assessment and using it to help individuals and help companies get the right people on board. We're going to talk right now about putting the right employees in the right roles is important, but it's not enough. Why is that?
Very good question. You know, and this is based on our research around what really matters in performance. And we found that there's two fundamental, you know, units that matter when it comes to performance. One is getting the right person in the right role with the right fit, which is what we talked about last segment, which can be augmented heavily by assessment. But the other one is getting the team to operate effectively. And we've all seen it. We've seen really smart people in a team make really dumb decisions.
No.
No, shocker. Not you, Dave.
And,
you know, not your outfit.
Oh, no. No, we've never done anything wrong. Okay, continue.
So what is that all about? We're all about the ROI, and what's the return on investment? What's the financial impact? We actually have gone out and measured the financial impact of ineffective collaboration and bad leadership team decision-making, and we found the impact to be 20 to 30%. It's what we call the drag coefficient, the noise that gets in the way of lack of quality decision-making among so many teams. And so a big part of our focus is, you know, one, getting the right people in the right seats, and then two, getting those seats to operate in a collaborative manner. And when we go into an organization and we show the impact on the bottom line of their ineffective decision-making, it's pretty profound. And this kind of soft and fluffy thing that so many leaders may think team building is, and it often is really matters it, as long as it actually gets to the end result, which is high-quality decision-makings. By people bringing it all, bringing everything they have and sharing everything they have and building off each other's ideas to come up with the right solutions. So we do get after it. We get after that drag coefficient. And we work with companies to get rid of the noise that does impact the bottom line.
Well, it's no question that negativity can impact an organization in a big way. Matter of fact, we all know that negativity impacts the organization far more than positive does. And that's human nature as well. So the reality is if you can lessen that drag on the organization in any way, it really will create higher quality decisions.
Absolutely will. And so, you know, when you look at what goes into high quality decision, you know, teams, we have our list of predictors. And then we go in and we'll do a quick assessment. We'll identify where are the strengths and gaps of this team and where are they in the evolution of high performance. And then we'll jump in and work with the team, how it's comprised, how the leader's behaving. Often that means, you know, we'll have a day session with them. And coming out of there, they'll have a clear path and set of actions that not only will make them feel good working with each other, but more importantly will have a direct impact on them capturing more value for the organization. You know, it's interesting. When we started doing this whole performance thing around teams, our goal wasn't to make people enjoy their work. Our goal was to have teams to operate for high performance. But what we found is the net byproduct of high-performing teams is they love what they do. They go hand in hand. When people are performing at a high level as a team, they also are highly engaged, and it's a byproduct of it. So it's been very gratifying, and again, it's how we can actually measure how teams and their ability to operate together impact the performance, financial performance of the company.
We've been talking with Joe Frodsham and his new book, Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization. But before we go, Joe, I know that you've worked on a new article that's coming out, and it goes right to the heart of what HR and CFOs talk about all the time, and that's coaching ROI. You know, people talk about all these team buildings, all this coaching, but there has to be a return on investment or ROI. And you have a new article coming out. I know it's on jbkfgroup.com. People can go there and look this article up. Talk to me just a minute or so about that article and what the key point is.
Absolutely. It's coaching for ROI. And what we found is that you can actually identify and measure the return on investment of coaching, but you have to design for it. You actually have to design up front so that your coaching will kind of have map directly to those things that are important to the organization, including the financial outcomes. And so we've had some real success doing that. You know, in the article, you'll see that we've captured one coaching engagement where we've seen a capture of millions of dollars directly attributable to the new behaviors that that leader was able to acquire through the coaching. So those kind of things are exciting. But you can't just measure it on the back end. You have to design for it on the front end. You have to design what are the objectives and how does that map to the strategy and the financials, and then track it along the way. But what we found is it not only brings greater value to the organization, but credibility for coaching in general. And when HR brings that in, their ability to influence and get stuff sold obviously goes up dramatically.
You know, we've had a wonderful conversation today talking about engagement, talking about assessment, talking about, hey, your new book, Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization. We talked about the new coaching ROI here at the end, and I'm going to direct everybody to go to jbkfgroup.com to make that happen. Or, of course, you can go to the hrpowerhour.com right after the show. You can click and buy Joe's new book. I appreciate you, Joe, very much for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you. This has been delightful, David, and stay warm, my friend.
We absolutely will. And now the HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group. Licensed agents in 28 states, business, commercial, and personal. Go to northerninsurancegroup.com. According to HRMorning.com's article, Dealing with Angry Employees, Four Tips for Managers by Tim Gould, the article starts, we've never heard a manager grouse about a shortage of employee complaints. We've heard a few moan about how to handle those complaints, though. So here are some tips that he provides. First, let the person vent. Managers should show empathy by saying something like, I'd be too upset, too, if I was dealing with this, or I get why you're frustrated about the situation. Important, don't take the anger personally. They're just venting about a problem. Two, repeat after me. Once he or she is done speaking, the manager should paraphrase and repeat back what they think they heard. An example, if I heard you correctly, the problem is X and you need Y to be done about it. Three, be real. There may not be an easy solution that the manager can come up with right away, so the supervisor should ask them what kind of resolution the employed person would like in the meantime. Make sure that you're realistic. It will go a long way. And then four, if necessary, end it. With the vast majority of human population, these steps will diffuse the situation, but there are always a few folks who won't calm down and act rationally. If that's the situation, certainly try to first say, look, I can't continue talking to you if you won't calm down about this. Let's talk about it later. If that doesn't work, then you may have to go and talk to security or one of the other people in the plant to help calm down the situation. And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group at northerninsurancegroup.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking with author Ken Lizotte. He is the Chief Imaginative Officer for the Emerson Consulting Group. And we're going to be talking about why HR leaders should develop and even publish their own ideas and why HR leaders should become thought leaders and how to go about it. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.